Why are NHS whistleblowers being hounded out of their jobs?
Our political editor asked the key question of Keir Starmer.
What do you say to people who claim that you're just a copycat player?
And why did someone try to kill the Slovakian Prime Minister?
Welcome to The Daily Tea with me, Kamal Ahmed.
And me, Camilla Tominey. Well, before we get to the most read story on the Telegraph website, it's gone gangbusters because it's a great, great scoop about NHS whistleblowers. Kamal, you're back in a suit. You were in a suit yesterday.
I know.
Pray tell, how did your meeting with the King and Queen at Buckingham Palace
just
go?
Just to reassure everyone, the turtleneck will be back on Monday. That is my pledge. I'm actually off to the Irish Embassy tonight for their annual reception. But yes, yesterday, tea with the King. Didn't actually shake hands with the King, sadly, Camilla. I didn't use my elbows to muscle through.
Tell us how many of those, they're actually not cut as triangles or squares.
They're actually rectangles.
They're rectangles.
The sandwiches are rectangles.
They're crustless. How many of them did you get down your neck? Be honest.
It was four, actually, and two eclairs.
What?
I know.
Any scones?
I was quite hungry because we'd recorded the podcast and I hot-footed it down there. I was quite hungry. I missed my lunch.
And also, when you were taking the cakes, because this is difficult, were you putting the cake like wholly into your mouth? Because it's hard to eat them, isn't it?
No, we sat down on the beautiful deck chairs that they provided. Not deck chairs, they're sort of soft canvas chairs. I want to make sure I'm accurate. And we had a beautiful afternoon eating the sandwiches, cucumber sandwiches, and there were other beautiful things, cup of tea. And then what was lovely was that everyone who serves you calls you sir and ma'am, like you are genuinely
yes.
a member of the royal family.
And ma'am is in jam, not ma'am is in smarm, because that's not how you address royalty, just
so
to make
well
that
there.
Point.
And I kept my pinky down, as you suggested yesterday, Camilla. Anyway,
right. Should we get
on
into this extraordinary story on NHS whistleblowers? The scoop is that they have been hounded out of their jobs for raising safety concerns. You would expect, wouldn't you, in the NHS, that if doctors are coming forward saying that patient safety has been compromised, that their bosses listen to them, address the issues, come up with some kind of investigation to make things better. In fact, Kamal, the opposite seems to be happening. We've done an investigation into just how many doctors seem to be affected by this. Our findings, I think, look like they're the tip of the iceberg. So they've spoken to more than 50 doctors and nurses who have told the Telegraph that they've been targeted after raising concerns about upwards of 170 patient deaths and nearly 700 cases of poor care. One consultant has described it as the biggest scandal within our country and said the true number of avoidable deaths was, quotes, astronomical.
We're going to be joined by Janet Eastham, one of the investigations team that uncovered this amazing story, and also our associate editor, Gordon Rayner. And they're just coming in hot-footed from the newsroom now into the studio. Welcome to them both.
Hello, guys.
Janet, welcome. Come and have a seat here. And Gordon,
hi.
Lovely to see you.
Have you seen the studio before?
No, we haven't. We just see your backs normally.
There you have. And you two, we've been seeing your backs because you've both been sitting together in the newsroom, hunched over your computers, working on this story. So I suppose the first obvious question to ask is, how did it come together?
Well, I was contacted by a contact of mine who told me about this and told me about some meetings that were happening online of doctors who had been whistleblowers, who felt they'd been victimised. I was invited to listen in, sit in on one of these Zoom meetings one evening. They go on for about a couple of hours. I felt there was a story here. So we brought Janet on board to bring her skills to the table. And Janet?
Well, I thought doing a survey would make it easier to get on top of all the different stories, which was a bit naive, actually, looking back, because I'd basically set up what was a Google form, essentially,
yes.
where I asked questions around all the different aspects that Gordon had described to me when he went to the meeting. So referrals to the regulator, raising of concerns, the kind of investigations that go on inside the hospital. So one of the things that you pointed out was that the doctors often feel, and the nurses and the midwives feel like they're more likely to be investigated than the patient safety concerns, which was borne out by our survey results, although obviously the NHS is saying they're taking it very seriously.
Mm.
So I created a Google form that I thought would cover everything, but I asked people to put their email addresses in. So after I got all the data in, I then had to start speaking to everyone involved. And that's kind of where the issue exploded, really, because you sort of realise the personal toll that this has taken. And also that these are very normal doctors and nurses, just as for doctors describe themselves as a very conservative bunch, you know, they often don't realise they're whistleblowing when they raise concerns.
Yes.
Yeah, they're not activists. Yeah. Are they?
Yes, they're not activists.
When Kamal and I were discussing this before coming on air, what we can't get our head around quite is the idea that surely the NHS should be happy that people are blowing the whistle because patient safety is being compromised. Mm-hmm. You'd expect that to then, you know, sunlight's the best disinfectant, let's investigate these claims, let's hear what's going on. But actually, you've discovered the complete opposite happens.
Yeah, rather appallingly, what seems to be happening within the NHS is that their first instinct is to try and protect themselves, to protect their reputations, to cover their backs, in a lot of cases anyway. And so they will target the whistleblower rather than targeting the problem. And there were quite a lot of people made the analogy to the airline industry and said that this doesn't really happen in private hospitals. Private hospitals are much more risk averse. They know that they can go out of business if they have a big scandal. So they deal with these problems at source. The NHS can't really go out of business. It's a huge organisation, so it's much easier for managers to sort of do these things and then not suffer any consequences.
What, Gordon, could we learn from the airline industry in terms of how it approaches complaints being made?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not an expert on transport, but from my understanding, the aviation industry has a sort of complete zero tolerance approach to risk, and certainly in terms of when concerns are raised, they immediately deal with them. They do it in a very open way. Very often they publish their reports. If you're an airline and planes start falling out of the sky, you're not going to be around for much longer, are you? Whereas a hospital, an NHS hospital, can't really go bust.
I think, Janet, it's really interesting what you said, that the people don't call it whistleblowing. They're just raising concerns. And one interesting point is, if they're spending this much money defending the NHS legally, surely that means that that money is not being spent on patient care, which seems another layer of appallingness about what you've uncovered.
Yes, I mean, that's definitely what I'm hearing from the doctors and nurses I've spoken to. In one case, there's been some nurses who have raised concerns with the CQC. They have, they say, been targeted by their trust. And one of the things that they said to me that really, really stuck with me is, I mean, it's not even patient care. In one of the wards, the patient toilets haven't been dealt with for years, and yet they believe the trust is spending quite a lot of money going after them when these basic things, it's not even care, it's toilets, haven't been addressed.
Can we talk about the toll it's actually taken on doctors and nurses? Gordon, I know earlier in the week you wrote a very moving piece about GPs who are feeling so under pressure that they're contemplating taking their own lives.
Yeah.
You've spoken to people here that have really been pushed to the brink on this.
Yes, I mean, as you say, I did a separate piece about the problem of GP suicides, which isn't always, sometimes it is, not always connected to these sort of whistleblowing cases. And yeah, they feel that they've got nowhere left to go. They feel like they've run out of road. And I think also with doctors, and I'm sure Janet will talk about this as well, with doctors, they define themselves by what they do for a living. And if you take that away from them, they become pretty desperate. They feel like they've got nothing.
Yeah, I mean, it's not just doctors, it's nurses and midwives as well. You know, it's their identity. I've spoken to one nurse who sort of said, this is all I am. I am a nurse. What am I now? You know, now that she's no longer working in the NHS. I mean, in this case, the trust has already acknowledged failings in her case, and so has the NMC.
What's the NMC, yeah.
So
Janet?
The NMC is it's the nursing regulator. So yes. This is the body that is there to make sure the public is safe, that, you know, nurses are fit to practice. And in this nurse's case, she's quite an unusual case in that she initially raised concerns about a colleague who was sexually harassing her. She only later learned after NHS England did an external report that actually the nurse she'd reported had allegedly also behaved in an inappropriate way towards vulnerable mothers whose sick children were being looked after in the hospital. She raised concerns over 8 years, in fact. And the end result is that she is no longer working in the NHS. And I mean, as Gordon was saying, when you are a doctor or a nurse, they've trained for their whole lives to do this. You know, she worked for 30 years in the NHS, and to feel rejected by that and to not be able to do it, I think it's the loss of identity that is the most destabilising factor here. And I think it's not unlike the post office scandal in that sense, that as with the sub-postmasters, these doctors and nurses, they feel themselves to be the only one, to be completely alone with this. And I think that's one of the things that is the most difficult in terms of their mental health. And one of the things we covered in our first day was this group that's come together, this Justice for Doctors group, which really is a support group for doctors. It's more than a campaigning group, really. It's a it's a support group. It's how they come together. They learn that the tactics, it's not a personal matter. This is not a personal target on them. This seems to be more of a general approach that many of them suffer. And I think that that does seem to be helping them in terms of coping with it from a psychological point of
strength
view.
Strength in numbers, really.
Yes, to realise it's not just them.
And also, obviously, it puts others off from whistleblowing. This is a main problem. Mm. I'm intrigued as well, Gordon, to hear the response from some of the trusts or indeed the Health Secretary, Victoria Atkins. Mm. What have they said about this story?
Well, we went to Victoria Atkins before we published the story. She said that she has brought in various extra protections for whistleblowers, which I think is true. But clearly, they're not working well enough. But she also acknowledged that there is more still to do. So it's going to be interesting over the next few days to see what they do say that they're going to do. Certainly, what the doctors want is they want changes in the law to make it illegal to cause detriment to somebody who speaks up. They want a ban on excluding people from work if they whistleblow. And they also want independent medical experts to be brought in to assess the merits of whistleblowing claims. So they think all of those things together will help to sort of avoid the situation where hospitals can effectively mark their own homework because at the moment, you know, a whistleblower raises a concern to their manager. They say, leave it with us, we'll deal with it, and then we've seen what happens.
Let's hope there is some progress. Camilla, so many times we cover these huge failings of NHS processes, of NHS care of patients, of NHS care of their own colleagues, doctors and nurses. I mean, in Monday's podcast, we were talking about the birth trauma report and terrible services many, many women receive from the NHS. But still, of course, the NHS itself is almost beloved by the public, gets these huge high ratings. I do struggle with the disconnect between the type of work, Janet and Gordon, you're doing here for us, and the birth trauma report that we covered, Camilla, on Monday, and these high ratings. What is it about the NHS that seems to have this love and this disconnect with so many things that are revealed that are really poor?
Well, I think, the NHS has become a religion in this country, and it's very hard to criticise it because it wasn't that long ago that we're all standing on our doorsteps clapping for the NHS and trying to save the NHS. I think that you can quickly come unstuck from a political perspective if you start criticising the NHS because we do know how hard doctors and nurses work. And also, by the way, if we're in an emergency situation, we know how important the NHS is to be there to save us. The reader's reaction to this story is interesting because, once again, what's the word that keeps on reoccurring when it comes to the NHS? Reform. So we keep on having this debate, and maybe part of the problem is actually the politicisation of the issue. And there's been lots of calls, haven't there, for the NHS to be looked at by a royal commission, completely independent of politics. But as far as the readers are concerned, you know, they're angry about the notion of a cover-up. I think they're angry about whistleblowers being penalised rather than anything being done about what they're trying to call time on. One reader, I think, summarises here the patient's perception of these sorts of stories. It makes me absolutely raging angry that patients are dying due to huge medical errors, maternity being the most recent example, and NHS management is sacking extremely brave whistleblowers to protect their backs rather than doing the right thing and putting patients first. The NHS is failing due to its top-heavy, incompetent management. Name them and sack them with no pension. The last bit might be extreme, but you can understand the emotion there. Mm. We're really emotionally supportive of the NHS, but really emotionally unsupportive of what is perceived to be, at times, problems with middle management and not with frontline workers.
The system more, as you said, Janet. Gordon, Janet, obviously a lot more to come on this. What's coming up next and what can we expect to see over the next few days? Because now this has started, we have to keep focused on it.
Yeah. Well, you were talking about middle managers. We're now looking at what happens to those managers who are involved in these cases where whistleblowers do end up being forced out of their jobs. You won't be surprised to learn that a lot of them get promoted.
Really looking forward to reading the rest of the investigation. Thank you for coming into the Daily Tea studio today.
Thanks so much.
Pleasure.
Kamal, just in the interest of balance here, NHS England have released a statement to us in response to the story where they are stressing, and I think it's an important point worth making, that they have come up with this speak up policy. So in reaction to stories like these, the NHS has said to itself, we need to better support colleagues, we need to encourage them to speak up. And in that statement, it very much pushes the point that we're giving our staff the freedom to try and air some of these complaints and try and get them to see the light of day.
Yes, and they've also said in the statements they've given us that when people are disadvantaged, when they say they've been negatively affected by whistleblowing, they are giving them enough support.
Hopefully the good thing about a story like this is it raises the bar even higher and the NHS has to say to itself, look, we've got groups of doctors now coming together, sharing group grievances. This is something we've got to seriously address.
Now, after the break, before we come to Labour's 6 general election pledges, we'll be talking about that terrible video that went viral on the Telegraph website, the attempted assassination of the Slovakian PM just yesterday.
Welcome back. We're going to start speaking about Keir Starmer's 6-point plan in just a moment, Shades of the Ed Stone, which we'll get on to. But first, the video that went most viral on the Telegraph website yesterday, Kamal, was this extraordinary scene that played out in Slovakia when the Slovakian Prime Minister Robert Fico was shot at on Wednesday. This is the footage. So the pro-Russian politician was shot several times in the western town of Handlova on Wednesday.
And that horrific footage was captured by the Slovakian channel RTV. So today, the Prime Minister's condition has been described as stable but serious. Yesterday, there was a belief that he could actually have been murdered, which would have been obviously even more appalling. We were discussing this morning, Camilla, and of course, lots of people won't know much about Slovakia and its politics. So we asked one of our common editors and foreign news expert, Francis Dernley, just to explain the why and the what.
An assassination attempt on any political leader is always a major story. But this one, on Slovak Prime Minister Robert Fico, is significant on fronts that transcend the usual shock of violence towards elected representatives. The 59-year-old was hit in the abdomen by bullets fired by a 79-year-old poet and received life-threatening injuries. Crucially, among the first to condemn the attack was Russia's President Vladimir Putin. That is because Slovakia is one of Europe's fault line nations, facing an inner battle over its future, namely whether to align itself more closely with the economies and values of the West or with Russia. As we see in Georgia, protests have seized the streets of Tbilisi in opposition to legislation they claim came from the Kremlin. In Ukraine, President Zelensky is fighting for its very survival against Moscow. And in Moldova and certain Balkan nations too, there is a similar struggle as Putin seeks to keep former Soviet states within his orbit. In this Cold War II, Robert Fico has presided over a shift from pro-West to growing sympathies with Moscow since his election victory last September. The left-wing populist steered his party strongly against military support for Ukraine, vowing in a pre-election interview with The Telegraph last year that he would cut arms supplies to Kyiv altogether. As such, Russia was very quick to condemn this attack, knowing it faced potentially losing a key ally at this precarious moment. Putin said he was indignant and that there can be no justification for this monstrous crime. Indeed, the Kremlin's propagandists were quick to try and find ways to blame Ukraine for the assassination attempt. Though curiously, from what we can tell of the attacker so far, he actually had links once to a pro-Russia group. Not that this will matter to the propagandists in the Kremlin, of course. Already, the chairman of Russia's Foreign Committee has said, and I quote, "There is a high probability that the West wanted to kill Fico because of his political values, which do not fit into the stereotypes of the hegemony of the collective West." Suffice to say, there's no evidence for this. And indeed, there was universal condemnation of the attack from Western leaders yesterday, including President Zelensky. Estonia's Prime Minister, Kaja Kallas, spoke for many when she said, "An attack against an elected leader is also an attack against the very idea of democracy." But it's that idea of democracy, and specifically the degree of influence which Russia has over other countries' elections and futures, which is currently being fought in both political and military arenas in Europe. It is a conflict that is currently playing out in Slovakia too, which is why Fico's fate is so significant.
Well, Keir Starmer, the Labour leader, and members of the shadow cabinet were in Thurrock in Essex today, shamelessly parking their tanks on Tory lawns to launch their 6 general election pledges. Why is it always 5 or 6?
Very, very excited.
I'd like to see 13 general election pledges, really. It follows on from Rishi Sunak laying out his own sort of pre-election pitch in a speech on Monday. Starmer says he has presented voters with his first steps for change. There's 6 of them, Kamal. Should we say one each?
I think we should do one each because there are only 6. So let's go from the very top. 1, deliver economic stability.
2, cut NHS waiting times.
3, launch a new border security command.
4, set up Great British Energy.
5, crack down on anti-social behaviour.
6, recruit 6,500 new teachers.
I'm going to be coming back to you, Camilla, at the end of this programme to see if you can remember any of those at all. The point is, why are these things, as you say, laid out at all? It really goes back to the idea of what are these pledges for? And it is all about the offer to voters. How can you simplify politics? Because we might be following this day by day, the whole political discussion, but for the public, they may plug into this every now and again, and they want to know from the different parties as we approach an election, and frankly, the election campaign has pretty much launched now, what it is these two parties are going to give me. And the most famous pledge card, of course, that some people at least will remember was the one done by Tony Blair in 1997 when he came out with the 5 pledges that, of course, were put out before he won the election. And I was at the Labour Party conference last autumn, and so many senior Labour officials still have that pledge card, slightly dogged, in their wallets. It became a sort of totemic notion of how Blair won the election, with a set of what are called retail offers, really straightforward things we are going to do. Most of his were focused around education.
Kamal, as somebody who's described himself as a metropolitan liberal elitist, do you still have your copy of the pledge card, or is it framed somewhere in the Ahmed household?
Sadly not, although, Camilla, I must admit, I did go back and have a little look at them. Ooh. And as a set of offers, which I think we'll get into with this, Keir Starmer, for me, has not nailed the actual retail sense, i.e. what will this do, in the same way that the 1997 Blair pledges did. Let me just run through them very, very quickly. Cut class sizes to 30, very simple to understand. Punishment of young offenders, cut NHS waiting lists, cut benefit bills by getting people into work, and no increase in income tax. That is a set of very clear offers to the public. I think Keir Starmer has slightly trapped himself with broader themes. Deliver economic stability. What does that mean?
No. We'll get on to that in a moment, because I'd like to just reflect, please, on the most hilarious set of Labour pledges ever made. And that was by Ed Miliband and the Edstone. You remember that, Kamal?
Who can forget the Edstone? Literally carved in stone.
Carved in stone. And do you remember when he announced and unveiled the Edstone?
These 6 pledges are now carved in stone. They're carved in stone because they won't be abandoned after the general election. I want the British people to remember these pledges, to remind us of these pledges, to insist on these pledges.
It's like remembering a very bad meal, isn't it? You just get that sudden sort of crippling notion of how bad it was. John Rentoul, who is Blair's biographer, I think summed it up in the most truthful way. I'm just going to read what John Rentoul said at the time. He said the Edstone was the most absurd, ugly, embarrassing, childish, silly, patronising, idiotic, insane, ridiculous gimmick I have ever seen. And I think even Ed Miliband has admitted it wasn't the high point of his political career.
Did we ever work out what happened to the Edstone? Because journalists were travelling around the country trying to track it down. I think at one point it was stuck in an old warehouse. Then somebody said it had been destroyed. Can you imagine somebody taking a sledgehammer to the Edstone with Ed Miliband in the background tears streaming from his eyes.
I don't think it's ever been found, has it, properly? No one's actually absolutely clear where it is. And maybe we should get our investigations team here to have a good look for it.
Should we go in search of the headstone at some point and do it for a podcast? We found the headstone as it's covered in sort of verdigris and decay.
I thought it was interesting watching Keir Starmer. Unlike Rishi Sunak, Keir Starmer's speech always sounds a little bit like a headmaster telling pupils. But in the questions and answer, he relaxed and actually seemed much more conversational, natural. We've spoken a couple of times, Camilla, about Keir Starmer struggles to sound genuine, even when he's being genuine.
Yes.
But actually watching him today in his speech in Essex, in the questions when he got off script, he did seem warmer. And I think there was something there around the way he's going to need to have conversations with the public as an election campaign comes. He needs to drop the slight teacher tone and become the more answering questions tone.
But there's a correlation there between Starmer and Sunak, because again, Sunak's better when he speaks human. You could say that Starmer's the headmaster. Sunak's problem is he's the head boy. I mean, there's this problem with his speaking, because he does sound like Will from In the Between Us. I'm sorry, but he does.
And for Sunak, the problem is when he is questioned, he can sound tetchy. Whereas watching Starmer do the questions, he thanked the journalists. That's a great point. Mm. Of course, they learn this technique, but that whole thing about this, that's a great point. Thank you so much. You raise a really interesting, you know, that whole
but
thing
But he was
happens.
A barrister. He should be used to debating.
He should.
Oh. Ben Reilly-Smith has just walked in.
Ben Reilly-Smith.
Hello. Sorry,
fresh,
again.
Fresh from Essex.
A favourite of the podcast. Ben, welcome back.
Ben Reilly-Smith, our political editor, just to introduce him. You're carrying the pledge card. Let's have a look
at
this.
I have it here. My first steps for change.
Ooh.
And it... If you unroll it, it has all of the six.
That's not a card, it's a
building
leaflet.
Up as blocks.
It is a leaflet, to be honest, yes.
It is a leaflet.
It's, they've been really original with the colours there, red and white.
But he looks quite sober. He's kind of not smiling.
Hang on, Camilla, those are Labour colours.
I know
fine.
They're
yes,
Labour
yes.
colours.
And your top colour.
Is he all right in that photograph?
Well, I think it's quite interesting because he's projecting this sobriety. Because we keep on hearing it's not 97. There's not this huge elation. It's a serious time. Economy's not good. So I think he's kind of adopting that mood.
Before we ask you what the mood was like in Thurrock in Essex, let's just hear a little bit of what Keir Starmer had to say.
Decline is not inevitable. Politics can make a difference. Britain will have a better future. And you can choose it with Labour. Stop the chaos with Labour. Turn the page with Labour. Return politics to service with Labour. And with patience, with determination, with these first steps, we can rebuild our country with Labour. Thank you very, very much. Thank you. Thank you.
Now, if anyone's saying that that is not the start of an election campaign by the Labour Party, they are talking, frankly, rubbish. Now, Ben, you also asked a question at the event. Let's hear that.
Ben Reilly-Smith from The Telegraph. Tony Blair had five pledges on his card. You have six today. Tony Blair had New Labour. You've got Change Labour. Tony Blair used to take his tie off at big events. I've spotted you. Don't have a tie on today.
Is there anything else you've spotted, Ben?
Well, what do you say to people about who claim that you're just a copycat Blair?
Well, look, the first thing I'd say about Tony Blair, which is more important than whether he took his tie off, is he won three elections in a row. And what Blair did in 97 is what Wilson did in 64 and Attlee did in 45, which was to take the Labour Party from opposition into power. We've only done it three times, effectively. And the thing that unites them was the ability to glimpse the future and to persuade people to go on that journey to a changed future. Obviously, different circumstances in 1945, as we all understand, 64, white heat. And then the challenges that were facing Tony Blair in 1997. In that way, there's similarities, because I do think you've got to glimpse the future, you've got to understand the challenges, and you've got to have serious answers to the challenges that we face.
Ben, quite a sharp contrast there with Ed Miliband, who, of course, quite aggressively tried to not ever lean into Blair's record. Also, what Starmer left out from the pledges, nothing on climate change directly, nothing on child poverty, nothing on workers' rights.
Nothing on housing.
They are clearly putting their tanks right in the centre ground. This is all about persuading maybe reluctant Labour voters to come to Conservatives from the right, not motivating Labour's core vote. What was your sense of this nod to Blair that you asked a very witty, I must say, Ben, question about?
Thank you. Well, I think why I asked it is the central message of this entire event seemed to be reassurance, reassurance, reassurance. Just providing to all the voters a reminder that you are safe to move to Labour if you're on the right of politics. I think it wasn't just what was in or out, but actually the way they phrased the pledges. So the first economic one, which is basically economic stability, we'll spend money quite carefully and we'll try and keep taxes and inflation low. I mean, that could have come straight out of the Tory proposal for their strategy on the economy. They weren't saying for the many, for the few, we're going to redistribute wealth in our society, is what Corbyn was saying back in 2019. And also, if you look at crime, it was zoomed in on antisocial behaviour. Well, who came up with ASBOs? It was Blair. And they seemed that idea that it's not these huge super crimes people care most about, but the idea that small, petty crimes in their neighbourhood are just going totally unpunished. So it's interesting what they're zooming in on speaks to that point, I think.
I love this idea that he's not trying to emulate Blair, even though he is precisely trying to emulate Blair. And by the way, why wouldn't he, when Blair's been the most successful Labour politician and Prime Minister of recent memory? The trouble is, I can see the appeal to people who are maybe toying with the idea of voting Labour. If you look at the Tories who are toying with the idea of voting Reform, I'm wondering how convincing this is going to be. I mean, let's have a look at that leaflet again, Ben. I look at this, it's flim-flam. What on earth does it mean to deliver economic stability? No detail. Cut NHS waiting times. Well, that's like, you'd have to say that, otherwise you'd be committing electoral suicide. Launch a new border security command. That's not a pledge, by the way, to bring down legal immigration. It's just to say that we've thought of something to stop the boats. Set up Great British Energy. Nobody knows what that is or what it means. Crack down on antisocial behaviour. As you say, Ben, that isn't a kind of crack down on crime and the causes of crime, which was a great Blairite slogan, maybe the most easy to understand, and it's got shades of Boris Johnson, recruit 6,500 new teachers. Maybe they can pick them up from the private schools that are inevitably going to have to close once they close that VAT loophole. But I think as far as Telegraph readers are concerned, they're going to look at this. This is the trouble with Labour. The further you try to delve into the detail, the less detailed it becomes. And the Tory attack line on this is going to be, well, he's come up with these pledges, but he's flip-flopped on so much, you won't be able to rely on it at all in 3 months' time.
And I think that's the central charge that you can make against Keir Starmer, because there was another point a couple of years back when he came out and said, here are my 10 priorities. It was when he was running for Labour leader, and they were things like mass renationalisation, scrapping tuition fees, and those promises are gone. I think his team say, look, they were never quite as firm as promises as that idea of a list of 10 appears. But it's a tricky political problem for Starmer. He was challenged on it. How can we believe this list when this old list doesn't stand anymore?
I think that top point about economic stability, they know, and speaking to people around Rachel Reeves, the Shadow Chancellor particularly, they know that this issue around economics still worries the public. And Tony Blair knew that. He had a whole drive around business support for Labour. At this event, Labour revealed that Seb James, the UK MD of Boots, was going to be a supporter of Labour. That's going to be an important part of their narrative. Just one thing to add around the Tony Blair win in 1997, which I think Keir Starmer hasn't actually managed. Yes, reassurance. But Blair had a more convincing narrative on social justice. What he managed to do, which I think was the skill of successful Labour leaders, is speak to the core as well as to the new. I still think Keir Starmer is trying too much to reassure the new reluctant voter than to motivate with aspiration his core. Blair had this idea of managing new voters, but also motivating the core to come out and vote. And Starmer's got quite a soft flank on core voters.
And there was a point that exactly speaks to that on the morning rounds this morning, when on the Today programme, Pat McFadden, who's the election chief for Labour, was challenged. Why have you let in Natalie Elphick, a figure on the right of the party who until a week ago didn't have a Labour bone in her body, and you are keeping out of the party Diane Abbott, who's been one of the
champions of the left for decades long and is still stuck for more than a year now in this kind of review about some comments she made for which he's apologised. And that speaks to that idea that is he doing too much to try and appeal on the right and not enough to excite on the left? I mean, their gamble is pretty simple. It's just a fact of numbers. The big chunk of voters you need to turn around are in the middle. And there aren't that many left-wing voters who push come shove are not going to vote for Labour because of the argument that it might let in Rishi Sunak. So it's just a numbers game.
Ben, two party leaders, two men who want to be the next prime minister, two speeches, you attended both. Who do you think's had the better week?
In pure political performance, projecting optimism and confidence, I think Starmer's was the more exciting speech when it comes to an election campaign. I think possibly because if you think Rishi Sunak didn't know a speech was coming from Keir Starmer, maybe they would have picked another venue if they knew, because he was in a think tank, small crowd, no huge clapping audience, speaking quite heavily on policy, whereas Keir Starmer was surrounded on all sides by cheering activists. He was doing this no notes, wandering around the stage thing that probably looks quite good on camera. So pure political campaigning moves, I think the second one was possibly stronger.
Ben, you've had a busy week. Thank you for coming in, not once, but twice to the Daily Tea. Lovely to see you.
Thank you for having me. I'd love to come back in a campaign.
Thanks so much, Ben. Very much part of the Daily Tea family. That's it for today. Do join us again tomorrow at 5 o'clock.
You won't want to miss tomorrow's episode because we're going to be covering one of the biggest scandals in NHS history. We're going to be looking at the contaminated blood scandal, the inquiry into what happened when so many patients were given blood that was infected back in the 70s and 80s. Cara McGugan, our colleague, has done a whole podcast series on this called Bed of Lies. She's spoken to most of the victims that are still alive and the families of those who aren't. And we're going to be putting together a special episode to look at this scandal ahead of the inquiry reporting back to the public on Monday. If you want to follow up on anything we've spoken about today, of course, visit the Telegraph website.
And you can also subscribe with the special Daily Tea link. And you therefore get your first month for free and then 2 months for £1.
Can I just summarise that with my basic maths? That is £1 for 3 months.
Head to telegraph.co.uk/DailyTeaSub.
While you're there, for goodness sake, sign up to the Daily Tea newsletter. Head to telegraph.co.uk/Daily Tea Newsletter.
We really want to hear from you, so please do get in touch on socials. We're at Daily Tea Podcast on X, Instagram, and TikTok, or email us on thedailytea@telegraph.co.uk.
And whatever you do, listen to the next episode at 5 p.m. tomorrow.